welcome to Five of the Best. This one is about engines. There's a few engines I think worthy of a mention, which I haven't mentioned. The Stirling engine is an amazing engine. It was invented by Reverend Stirling, who was tired of his parishioners getting blown up by the boilers at a time. And it works on a temperature difference. So if you can put it on a block of ice, and because the air is different to the ice, it'll work. In fact, you can hold it in your palm of your hand, and the heat generated from your body will make this motor work. And you can watch see it on YouTube. The next subject I'm going to talk about is engines, or jet engines. Since 1903, propellers have been used to get aircraft off the ground, but there has been a limitation on the propeller. It's limited by power. It doesn't matter how quickly you turn the propeller. In fact, the more quickly you turn the propeller, it does not get any more efficient. In fact, it gets less. And the propeller-driven aircrafts have always been low on power, and forget about crossing oceans. They just don't have the range. And by the 1930s, people were aware of this and were looking at alternatives. And in fact, in 1928, a young man called Frank Whittle wrote a paper on developing a jet engine. The RAF had taken notice of young Frank Whittle, and they had taken him under their wing, and with the aid of the RAF, he started to develop the new jet engine. And by 1930, he had actually got a jet engine, although it was extremely dangerous and very low in power. And it took 3 years for him to develop an engine, a reliable engine, although it was still very low on power. At the same time, in Germany, another young engineer called Hans Welkelm was doing exactly the same as him. And in fact, he was a lot further along with the design of his jet, and he had got the Heinkel plane company too interested. And in fact, the first jet aircraft was called the Heinkel 178, and that first flew in 1939. In 1939, a war had broken out between Germany and the rest of Europe, and the race was on really to find a viable engine and plane to start to become a first jet fighter. And after a few hiccups in Germany, the Messerschmitt 262 in 1942 was launched for testing. And in the UK, we had the Gloucester Meteor in 1943. But it was the Messerschmitt 262 which saw the first squadron of jet fighters in 1944. And once it took to the air, it had a clear advantage over the propeller aircraft it came up against. I mean, it was a huge advantage. And really, for Germany, the Messerschmitt 262 was just came too late in the war to cause any difference. The Americans, which came late onto the jet development, in 1945 grouped together the best most talented engineers they could find, and formed Skunk Works, what was later known as Skunk Works. And in 1947, Chuck Yeager did something what was thought to be impossible, and that is in his Bell X-1, the rocket-powered motor and rocket-powered aircraft, he broke the sound barrier. Although it was a rocket, the rocket and the jet, they work in very similar principles. The next record-breaking jet would be in 1957, when the U-2, the spy plane, which would fly at incredible heights, and it needed specially adapted engines. It would fly at 70,000 feet, or 21 miles above the Earth, and it was there as a reconnaissance plane to take pictures over Russia. And it was that high that no plane or missile could reach it. That was until 1960, when one was shot down. In fact, one of the more remarkable features is that the U-2 is still in service today. And some stats about it is it's got a 5,500 mile range. Its top speed is only 500 miles an hour, and there have been 87 built. The next development in jet technology came with the ramjet, which only works at very high speeds, and basically all it is a tube and it is the high speeds which compress the air, and then fuel is injected and ignited, and it's extremely quick. And in fact, it was used with one of the prettiest planes ever made, in my view, and that is the Lockheed Blackbird. It has a combination of turbojets and ramjets, and it is this spec which makes it travel up to Mach 3 at a height of 100,000 feet. The next engine I'm going to talk about is the first engine that brought mass transport for the mass people, and it's made it possible to travel around the country and brought countries and even continents closer together and made the world a much smaller place. The steam engine. The steam engine history goes back around 2,000 years when it was used for as a pump to pumping water. But really, the first commercial use for the steam engine came in 1698 when Thomas Savery used his water pump as to pump water basically out of coal mines, but also in factory powering looms. Like all boilers at a time, they were just prone to just suddenly explode. And having said that, the Savery water pump was still in production and still used in the late 18th century. The real breakthrough for steam engines came in 1781 with James Watt, and he patented a number of items which increased the engine's power. He made a rudimentary governor, and probably the most important is a separate condenser which made the engines much more powerful. The first steam engines with wheels on them started to appear in 1804, and but this was really just to maneuver the engine from one place to another. The first railway track was laid between Liverpool and Manchester in 1829, and it was built to haul coal between Manchester and Liverpool, and really it was just an industrial tool. The land which this is George Stephenson's baby, really, and he proposed the idea. And the land that the track was going to go on is a marshland, and he had to drain the land, make sure the land was stable for the tracks, and he actually invented the new steam engine called the Rocket, and at the time was the fastest steam engine around, travelling at an amazing 28 miles an hour. At the time, 28 miles an hour was twice as fast as any other steam engine at a going, and more powerful than any other steam engine. And he did this by he had holes in his boiler, and that made that the heat transfer between the water a lot quicker, and making the engine much more powerful. And in 1829, they had no idea. They thought this would be just an industrial tool to carry coal from one place to another. And it wasn't until they opened it up and loads of people came and said, "Oh, we want to ride on it." And so they built a carriage, and very quickly they realized that this was the way to go. A year later, there was 89 miles of track laid. 10 years later, in 1840, there was 1,400 miles of track laid. And by 1960, there was 11,000 miles of track laid. So in the space of 30 years, from practically nothing to 11,000 miles of track, that's a revolution. I'm going to talk about one steam engine, and that is the Mallard. And the Mallard is probably the prettiest steam engine, and it also holds the world record for speed of a steam engine, which it had set in 1938, and it set it at 125 miles. 126 miles an hour, which is a record that still holds today. In 1800, a new steam engine was invented with no pistons, and this was invented by Charles Parson and Carl Delavoye, and it is still widely used around the world today. Their idea is for a boiler to create steam and for the steam to drive a turbine and thus creating power. It is used by most modern ships today. Nuclear submarines use this as a power source, and the thing you're holding or listening to this is probably being powered by a steam engine which was invented over 210 years ago. And the next engine I could talk about is the internal combustion engine. It's hard to say who should be credited with this invention. Back in 1509, Leonardo da Vinci described a compression engine. Moving forward until the 18th century, American Samuel Morley patented a combustion engine which ran off gas vapor. But most people credit the internal engine, combustion engine, to be with Frenchman Etienne Lenoir, who produced the first internal combustion engine with pistons and connecting rods. And it was in 1876 that Nicholas Otto, working with Gottlob Daimler and William Maybach, developed the four-stroke engine. In fact, Otto's four-stroke engine is basically still in use today. With Nicholas Otto's four-stroke engine still recognisable as an engine today, there's really only been one other development in the internal combustion, and that is Nicholas Wankel's engine. And really, it's a stroke of genius, I think. It's got two moving parts, and it's basically a cylinder head which rotates round the cylinder. And I don't know why it hasn't caught on. It's very popular in motorbikes because, unlike pistons, there's less vibration. It just goes round and round and there's less vibration. But it's a tiny engine and it can produce almost exactly the same power as a normal engine. I'm going to talk about one car. And the car I'm going to talk about started its life in 1908. And it was the Henry Ford Model T car. The Model T has been credited as really the first affordable car for the masses, but it didn't start out that way. The first Model T car in 1909 cost $850, which was expensive. But with Henry Ford's idea of mass production line, things changed. By 1914, the cost of the car was $550. And a year later, it was $462, which meant that an assembly worker could actually buy a car with just 4 months' salary. But with continued efficiency on the production line, and by the 1920s, the price had dropped to $240. And at the same time, they were producing 10,000 cars a day on the production line. And in total, there have been 15 million Model T cars sold. The next engine I'm going to talk about is the most iconic engine of all time, or rocket of all time, and is of course Saturn V. This is the only rocket engine which is propelled man from the Earth's surface to a lunar surface. The project started in 1963 with Kennedy's speech about going to the moon, and NASA basically just employed the same people who made the successful Jupiter rockets. The Saturn V requirements when made was it should be able to lift a 41-ton payload into space. The Saturn V is basically just three rockets stacked on top of one another. The first one being a 42-meter section, the second being a 24-meter section, and the third being a 17-meter rocket. All topped together, the Saturn V stood at 110 metres tall. Once on the pad, the Saturn V, the first stage, which was filled with liquid kerosene and had a power of 17 million pounds of thrust. And with all that power, it still took 11 seconds to clear the tower. And in doing so, had already burnt 15 tonnes of fuel. But when the engine got going, it reached a speed of 16,500 miles an hour. And at a height of 67 kilometres, it would then detach, and it was time for the second engine to kick in. This was a liquid hydrogen, oxygen fuel, and it had 7 million pounds of thrust, and this would burn for nearly 2 minutes, and it would reach a height of 191 kilometers and reaching a top speed of 17,800 miles an hour. And the third rocket, another liquid hydrogen, oxygen, would kick in. It's only had a thrust of 250,000 pounds, and basically its job was just to launch off from Earth towards the moon. And this is what it did. And in 1968, the first crew landed on the lunar orbit, Apollo 11. And this was followed on by the following year with a second manned crew to do it, and then a third, and then the fourth, and then the fifth. And finally, the sixth and last manned mission to the moon in 1972. The last Saturn V rocket was used on March 14th, 1973, and it was to lift the biggest payload it's ever done, and that is the 120-ton Skylab. But finally, economics caught up with the Saturn V, and they certainly weren't cheap, and in today's money they would cost around £3.5 billion a rocket. And you might not sound that might not sound too bad to send a man to the moon, but in a period of a 2-year period between 1967 and 1969, they sent up seven. And there are two Saturn V rockets, 16 and 17, which are scrapped and which are now in museums. The next engine I'm going to talk about are search engines. And can you remember a time without Google, when you used to type in a subject into a search engine and used to come back with hundreds of sites, and you just had to take a pick luck, just potluck? And even 5 years before Yahoo, where you just put a search engine in and you just got page to page of underlined sentences for links, and you really did have to take your potluck. That was all about to change in 1995 when David Flo and Jeremy Young came up with the idea of a search engine. David and Jeremy would go to the various sites, and they would manually grade them and put them into different categories on their Yahoo site. And this was an incredibly crude but a very, very successful way of doing a search. And Yahoo very quickly became very, very popular. I mean, there was a number of other search engines at the time, loads. You just have to look them up, Lycos and Excite. But by 1995, they wanted to make money out of this, and it was Yahoo and Excite, the lead players. And the way they did this was becoming a one-stop portal for your daily news and everything. And this was very much to the detriment of their search engines, which actually got them the success they had. By 1998, two more Stanford boys, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, came up with what they thought was a better way to do a search, and that was that they saw the internet as a popularity contest, with each page having a link count to it. So if you search for a specific topic, their search engine would take you to the page with the highest links. It makes common sense, really. They launched Google in 98 at Stanford University, and the site became so popular that they, by 1999, they were asked to leave Stanford and look for money in the real world. The two ambitious boys, Larry Page and Sergey, wanted to keep Google going, and so they approached the search engines. They approached Yahoo and they approached Excite. And both of these companies had a chance to purchase Google for about $1 million, and neither of them did. In fact, none of the search engines at the time purchased Google, and this must have been a bit deflating. They approached venture capitalists Dave Shovington and Andy Bergstein, and in fact, when they gave a demonstration to Andy Bergstein, he was so impressed with them that he went to his car and wrote them a check for $100,000. And from here, they got the ball rolling. Other venture capitalists got involved. And then really the breakthrough was when John Doerr and Mike Moritz gave them $12 million each. So $25 million in the bank. The race was on to find a way to make money from the site. The last alternative, which they wanted to do, was go the Yahoo way and put banners on top of their pages. In 1999, they were in fact losing $500,000 a month, and very soon the money was going to disappear. And it was here that they approached. It was now that they approached Bill Gross, and his company was involved in advertising and internet advertising. And his idea was a very simple idea, but very successful, as we'll find out. His idea was that if you typed Beyonce into a search engine, that you were more likely to buy a Beyonce record. And Google had talked with Bill Gross, and the talks fell down. So what Google did was just develop a software, a very similar software to Bill's. And when they launched it, Bill sued, and they in fact settled out of court, but Bill is got a bucket load of Google shares out of it. Whenever you type the word cars into Google, BMW pay a fortune so that they have their site listed in the top three, and that's how they make their money now. They have the search engine on the left and the paid advertisers on the top three and on the right-hand side. It does make you wonder really how bright these two boys were if they couldn't figure that out. But